Good day and welcome to Inside Education, the programme that brings you the best from the world of education from an Irish perspective. You can contact the programme by Twitter with the handle @InsideEd or by email to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. My name is Sean Delaney and you can access hundreds of podcasts of all previous programmes on seandelaney.com/podcasts. On last week's programme, I introduced you to Professor Jeanette Bobbis from the University of Sydney, where she is a Professor of Mathematics Education and Research Director for the Sydney School of Education and Social Work. She lectures in mathematics education and conducts research into practicing and pre-service teachers' knowledge, beliefs and practices. Last week on the programme, we discussed student engagement in mathematics, motivating children to be interested in mathematics, how Jeanette Bobbis became interested in mathematics education and educating future teachers. I'm bringing you the second part of my interview with Jeanette Bobbis this week, and we began by discussing the importance of student feedback in teaching well at university level.
I'm constantly changing the way I teach, and student feedback is extremely important in influencing how I might change it. Sometimes the feedback that I might get, I can't change what I might do because I might be have constraints around through the university system or time. Time is one of the biggest constraints. But every so often, some of my students become really good at reflecting on their own practice, but on what they need to improve their practice. And when they feed back that reflection to me, it makes me reevaluate what I'm doing and rethink, and where I might need to go off and do some more reading, go off and explore a little bit more in my own research, my own practice. So I include my student teacher feedback very much in my planning for the following year, but also planning on the fly, meaning I try to get my student teachers will each week or every couple of weeks will do a reflective post online, and they reflect on what they might have read, what they might have heard in class, what they might have done as part of their co-teaching. They would do an online post. Their peers then respond to that online post. I might also respond, but what I do is I read their online posts and then I incorporate what they've said in the following week's class. So they can see I've read what they're talking about, right? But I've also adapted. So we were doing some lessons around algebraic thinking last year, and one of the student teachers on their blog, I suppose, or their discussion post, had written how scared they were that they were going to, their words were, stuff up the children, right? They were going to not be able to teach the children as effectively as what they would hoped. And they were really worried about going into the class and teaching a particular content area. Now, that fear had not been relayed to me, or I hadn't perceived that fear in class, right? So to actually read that, the student teacher had been very honest. Others then commented, I understand where you're coming from. I feel a little bit the same way. And so they helped that student relieve their fear. But more importantly, because I read that this was going on, I could address it straight away before it got too bad, before it got so bad that the student teachers were scared about going into the classroom.
And about how many students would you be working with in the classes?
I have classes of around 30, and I have three groups of 30. I might not do all the classes myself. I have colleagues that I also work with, and one colleague in particular that I work very closely with, and to get used to the way I teach, she spent quite a long time observing my classes and participating in my classes before she would go and teach her own. So she's quite confident now. Occasionally she still comes into some of my classes if it's a new content area or a new topic, but she came in quite regularly. I think it was about 2 years ago, she would come in every week to my classes, and she wouldn't take a passive role. She would sit back and watch for a while, see what was going on. But once the student teachers would start on a task, she would mingle with the student teachers and find out what they were doing, what was going on. So she's now already informed me that she's completely changed her practices as well. So I'm really pleased that I can help others in that respect.
And is she a teacher or is she a university
lecturer? A university lecturer, okay. Who is fairly new to the university teaching area.
You gave a talk yesterday evening in Dublin City University titled Creating a Distinctive Practice-Based Teacher Education Program Through a Research-Informed Approach. What was the main message of the talk?
Because I have always used a practice-based approach to my teaching, but the way I've used the term has changed quite dramatically over the years through my own research into my own practices. I used to use the term much more broadly. I used to believe, and I think a lot of people still use the term practice-based teacher ed to mean where there's a lot more connections between or a lot more exposure of student teachers to the practice of teaching. So they might, for example, do a lot more assignments that occur in a classroom, or they might spend a lot more time observing or a lot more time teaching. But over the years, I've realized that that's important, that exposure to classroom practice. It's not sufficient. It's not sufficient for my student teachers to actually learn how to enact the practice at the level at which I think is important for effective teaching. So now, the message I was trying to get across on my talk was that it's not as important where the teaching or the teacher education might occur, but it's really important that the student teachers develop a deep understanding of the practice, the knowledge behind the practice, have a clear articulation about what the practice is aiming to do and why you're doing it with the children. So linking that practice with a theoretical basis and also a research and evidence base about why it's a significant practice. But then rehearsing it, this is really the link between that translation between the theory and the practice, being able to rehearse it at a level where they almost can be automatic in implementing it in the classroom. Because you think you're going to do something in the classroom, but the moment something stressful happens, you know, it might be some misbehavior or a child comes up with a response that you're not expecting, then you almost forget what the new practice you were going to do. You go back to what you knew best, which is the way you were taught. Right? So try again, this is where my engagement work came in, building up that resistance, that persistence and resilience for my student teachers through really having a deep commitment to that practice. So I think that's a major difference to me is around getting them to develop that ability to enact the practice and have the knowledge around the practice. So not just go off and do it because I've seen someone else do it, but really understanding why I'm doing it.
And when you're using the word practice there, are you referring to specific practices of teaching, or are you talking more about the practice of teaching? How are you using the word there?
I probably can use the term in both ways, depending on the context. I have used the word quite generally in the past about teaching practice, but now when I'm using the word, and with my student teachers, it's much more practice-focused, and I'm not thinking of micro-teaching skills like questioning is, yes, that is a practice which we do, but I'm thinking if you think about if you're trying to elicit students' reasoning and strategies, yes, you've got to ask them questions to do that. So that's an important part of that bigger overarching umbrella practice. So I'm much more on some very clearly articulated focusing on some practices. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. And I suppose I'm wondering, what practices are they?
One of them is actually eliciting student thinking and responding to students' thinking. Another one is holding a discussion, a class discussion, which you do, any teacher does all the time. But how do you hold... We almost assume that teachers are going to know how to hold a class discussion, but a really effective class discussion involves everyone in the classroom. So how do you make sure that you get every single child in that room contributing at a deep and meaningful level, right? And move the children's thinking forward, right? So holding a discussion is another. Another one that's really important in the area of mathematics is determining what representations you want children to use. So looking at children's representations is another practice.
You also have a role as research director. What does your role as research director involve?
As a director of research, that's for the new Sydney School of Education and Social Work at the University of Sydney. And in the past, that role has included ensuring that certain mechanisms are in place at the school level to support my colleagues to conduct their research. So the role, it varies quite considerably from mentoring individual staff members to conducting workshops. While I might not conduct them myself, I might co-opt colleagues. For example, we have each year a writing retreat, and one of my colleagues who has a particular research base, it's one of the things that he will research is about academic writing. He is the one that works on or takes those workshops, and there might be we call it a writing retreat. It might go on for 2 or 3 days. So my role as a research director is to facilitate that writing retreat taking place.
Can you say a bit more about the writing retreat? How exactly is it organised? Do you go somewhere, or do you just lock down in the university and
It's important to actually move out of the university context, because so many interruptions and people are so tempted to check emails or go back to their office and do another work. So, yeah, a little bit of isolation is actually a good idea. So I know the way my colleague who runs the writing retreat, he has a balance between structure and some freedom and time for writing. So he will do introductions where he will talk about what is a good writing a journal article, what is a good journal article. He will then give the participants in the workshops some time to write. He will ask them to bring along writing that they might have already started. And then he will set up some peer teaching, if you like, or peer feedback. So colleagues will swap pieces of writing and give feedback around certain criteria that they might have discussed in the workshop. So they unpack their own writing. They then go back and rewrite parts. But as the workshop or the writing retreat, the 3 days, moves on, there is more and more time given over to independent writing.
And how often do you organise the writing retreat?
It's only occurred once a year for the last couple of years, and a lot of my colleagues have said, could we have it more often? The difficulty is actually finding 3 days to actually isolate out of a busy academic year. It is a cost involved, because we pay for a retreat off campus and there's nice food included, so it's a special time. So what I did do is, in the last 12 months, I established some writing advisors in the school. And so I have my colleague who runs the writing retreat is a coordinator, and then I asked for nominees, for people who had an interest in supporting and mentoring other people. And I got 3 colleagues who are extremely wonderful people, who are good writers themselves, who have a good publication track record, but are also very good at relating to other staff. And these 3 colleagues work with my colleague who runs the retreat, and they will follow up on people who attended the retreat to see how their writing's going. They might hold regular mini writing sessions. One of my colleagues holds a weekly or fortnightly drop everything and write session. And whereas another one of my colleagues...
Is that hosted for students or hosted
no,
for
that's
peers?
No, purely for staff, okay. All right, for their colleagues, their peers, that's right. So we do run other workshops quite separately for our higher degree research students. Right? Okay. But my specific focus is on helping my colleagues develop good writing skills or good writing habits, and also in producing quality, because with our research assessment, which is another part of my role as director of research, is to prepare for our roughly 3 to 4 yearly. It's called the Excellence in Research of Australia era. And the next one occurs in 2018. So part of my role is to prepare, making sure that my colleagues submit their publications to a database, a collection that we can then ensure from there we have to select certain quality examples of writing that might be submitted to the Commonwealth, the Australian Research Council, for evaluation.
And is participation in the writing retreat mandatory or is it optional?
It's totally optional, voluntary.
Okay, well, and about how many?
Okay,
varies, or what percentage? Even?
Yeah, it varies. It might only be 10% of staff, and it varies. While a lot of the people that tend to come are more early career researchers, we co-opt a lot of our more experienced researchers to come along at certain times that might be able to provide writing feedback. But we've had professor level people also attend the retreats, and sometimes I've attended the retreat myself in the past for two reasons. One was I was working on a particular paper and I just couldn't get the time to finish it, so I decided that this was a way of isolating 3 solid days to work on the paper and get a good chunk of it written. I've also just been writing papers with colleagues, so the colleague and I decided we would go together. And that was a forced way of getting us to sit together and work on something. So, you know, people use the retreat for various reasons. We also have a separate section of the retreat where we've worked on writing of research grants. So we have a grant writing workshop as well. And these are things that staff have said that they need. So that's what we try to do.
And what kind of incentives do staff have for producing research in your university or in Australia in general?
Well, the University of Sydney is a research-intensive university, and the Sydney School of Education and Social Work has had an extremely excellent reputation for research internationally and also nationally. So we have a research-intensive environment, so it is conducive to, important for staff to publish their research, not only for promotion, but I think that a lot of my colleagues actually very passionate about their research, enjoy doing it, and it's like everywhere else though, it's a fine line between balancing between your commitments of teaching, administration, and research. But there are a lot of supportive mechanisms, and some staff are very good at tapping into those mechanisms. So I myself was very fortunate a few years ago where I applied for a research fellowship. It was particularly fellowships to support women. And because I had been involved in administration for a long period of time, I was fortunate enough to access this fellowship. It was called a Thompson Fellowship. And so for a full year, I was research only. And it was during that year that I was able to go to the United States and also in New Zealand, where the core practices movement is quite strong, or the ambitious teaching. So there's a lot of support mechanisms. You've got to be aware of them to start with, but then also utilise them.
Jeanette, you've introduced a new specialisation course in primary mathematics education in your university. Can you say a little bit about that?
This is something that we're very proud of. At the University of Sydney, we've always had a group of primary student teachers who have been exceptionally good at mathematics. And this is something quite unique, I think, that we've been able to capture, attract some of these top quality students that have also got high levels of mathematical background. But we didn't do anything with it. Like, we didn't really capitalize on that. And so a few years ago, my colleagues and I decided that we really needed some form of specialization for our primary math students who were already good and passionate about mathematics. So we lobbied some of the local government minister for education to ensure that it was going to get some traction if we decided to go down this way. At the same time, there was a national movement, Teacher Education Advisory Report, that came out, which actually recommended that specialisation in mathematics, science and technology and the languages was something that we should aim for and desirable, and then indeed that in the future they'd anticipate that all primary school teachers would have some form of specialisation. This doesn't mean that they don't teach general primary, like in Australia, primary school teachers are generalist primary school teachers, but what we were trying to do is capitalise on these student teachers who had a depth of knowledge and a passion for teaching a particular area such as mathematics, develop it even more and give them some credit for it, accredit them for this specialisation that they have. Of course, we were restricted that we had a limited time in our current courses, so we decided to embed a track or a trajectory through our current Bachelor of Education primary four-year degree where students could select certain subject areas, mathematics, so that they would specialise and they end up having, well, we have credit points, so they have to end up with a minimum of 36 credit points overall to count as a specialisation. So we capitalised on the existing courses that we had. We designed a few more subjects that we could slot in that were not going to disrupt the flow of the existing course. And then we highly recommend that our student teachers who want to do the specialisation will follow this track. So they still end up with their primary, general primary teaching.
So they can teach all subjects.
They can teach all subjects, but as well on top of that, the added advantage is that they have this in-depth understanding. They already have knowledge, but also pedagogical knowledge of mathematics.
Does that involve extra time that other students don't put into their course?
No, it's exactly the same amount of time. When they get to their fourth year, if they've followed the track through, we have a capstone, what we call units of study. And these are two subjects, one in each semester of the year. And these subjects can only be taken by the students who want to specialise in mathematics. And this is where we develop their leadership skills in mathematics, because we want these students to be not only good at mathematics, but they're going to become the leaders in their school of mathematics education. Right. And hopefully even beyond their school. That's our ambition for these student teachers.
And what other areas can students specialise in?
At the moment, no other area. We applied to the Board of Studies for our state, and we got special accreditation for our student teachers. So they will exit the program with an accreditation mathematics specialisation. The Board of Studies has also developed an accreditation for science and technology, and I have colleagues who are working on a science and technology specialisation track. But at the moment at our university, they can only come out with a mathematics specialisation.
Janet, we're coming near the end, so I have a few general questions. First of all, who or what inspires you?
I am inspired by the work of Elham Kassimi and Pam Grossman. Pam Grossman was one of the first people that I read their work about practice-based teacher education. You know, Deborah Ball is also up there in terms of her work around teacher knowledge, and she's also part of the Core Practices Consortium. They are more international people, but then more locally. Part of the reason why I stay at the University of Sydney is because I work with a really strong group of usually women, but it's not just women. It just so happens that all my maths education colleagues happen to be women. Jennifer Way, Judy Anderson, and Heather McMaster. They are passionate about their work. They are excellent teachers, excellent researchers. And I work better being with them. We help each other. And as well as that, they're so collegial. Also, my dean, Diane Mayer, who is a great role model for leadership, they are all colleagues that I extremely admire. So I think we are a much more productive team because of it.
Have you a favourite book or blog or writer about education?
One of the writers that first I became interested in was Kenneth Tobin in terms of co-teaching. I read a lot of work from Pam Grossman. I read a lot of work of Joe Bowler in terms of growth mindset. in terms of motivation and engagement. One of my colleagues from the past that I used to work with and still see quite regularly and work with, Andrew Martin, who is an educational psychologist. They would probably be the main.
Is Ken Tobin Australian?
He's based in New York at the moment.
If you could make one change to your current school and resources were not an issue, what change would you like to make?
Oh, we all would like more time for writing, more time for research, probably more money as what resources, money.
And what would you do with the money?
That would be for research. And for me personally, I would like to see the greater connection between my research and the practice. I think that our research does have an impact in the community, but we've not been very good at tracking that. So if I had more resources, more time, I would actually like to put it into finding some mechanisms that would be much better at tracking the impact of our research. And that's going to become much more important with the research assessment in Australia, like it has been in the UK, where their REF, their Research Excellence Framework, they have had a lot of big emphasis on impact and engagement in their research. And Australia is doing exactly the same, traveling the same pathway, where research impact is going to be a big issue. And after all, that's what we're doing the research for. Well, in my field, that's what I'm doing it for, is to make a difference to education. And so it's very, very important that we do follow through on that. You know, what's happening, what happened to the research we've done? Is it being put into practice? So that impact is something I'd like to follow up on.
And finally, what from your own primary or post-primary education informs your practice in education today?
I actually, as a student, enjoyed going to school. And I know that sometimes I used to hide that because it wasn't cool to be seen to enjoy school. But I did enjoy school. And I think I've taken that through to teaching my pre-service teachers, is that I still enjoy teaching as well. And I would like my student teachers, when they go out and to teach, well, if you're not enjoying teaching, then your children are probably not enjoying being taught. So, yeah, that enjoyment, do it because you love it, because you enjoy it. I still enjoy it.
And that positive note about teaching from Jeanette Bobbis brings this week's Inside Education to a close. I want to thank Jeanette Bobbis from the University of Sydney for her time in recording the interview when she was in Ireland to attend the 10th Congress of European Research in Mathematics Education. If you'd like to feature an idea or an event on a future programme, you can write to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. You can listen to podcasts of all previous programmes on seandelaney.com/podcasts. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.